Thank you very much, and thank you very much to Georges Callas for the invite to talk to you today about a subject that certainly I'm very passionate about, and I hope that there'll be some interesting and controversial things to discuss in the next few minutes. So we've heard very nicely introductions to critical metals already in the morning, and now I want to take that a bit further. We've thought about criticality and where do the resources that we're going to use come from, and I want to take us to think a little bit further about what actually is the source of them, and are they coming from places that we would be happy with? Are we happy about the materials that we're using? And can we think about that particularly with the critical raw materials? Because the whole point is these are usually very small markets, that we have very little choice about where these things come from. So is responsible sourcing something that we can think about now with respect to critical raw materials or not? And this is the diagram already we saw first thing this morning with the 2014 list of European Commission critical raw materials. And this is the rectangle with the critical ones in it, and there are a lot of them, so I can't cope with that in 25 minutes this afternoon. So I'm going to pick out to talk about, I'm going to take a bit of license because what's critical is indeed a moving target, and I'm going to pick these ones down here, tungsten, tantalum and tin, because these group, and you'll see, are the leaders in responsible sourcing agenda, I would say. And then I'm going to very briefly talk about niobium and then talk about who are the heroes and villains of critical metals and responsible sourcing. And then I'm going to talk about rare earths, which is my main research interest, and talk about how we can actually go to quite fundamental levels, I think, of geology and geometallurgy in thinking about responsible sourcing of those deposits. So done well, then, as we know, mining can be essential, of course, in providing the things, all the things that we use every day, and also a really important driver for sustainable development. And written here are benefits, and you might have more to add on things that it does, and that's done well. Done badly, mining, of course, can do all of this. Read down there. Sometimes that creates what's called the resource curse for countries, and that's really what we'd rather not think about, or certainly think that we are a part of in using these critical materials. So responsible mining then is simply about maximising the positive aspects of mining and minimising the negative ones. That's the aim of what we want to do. And a responsible mine, well, it must make money, first of all. A mine that's going broke is likely to bend the rules. And then we'd like it to do all the other things on this list. So when I mean responsible mining, I certainly don't just mean the socio-economics aspects that some people might mean by that phrase. I mean everything, the way the resources are produced. Is it an efficient mining technique? Health and safety and well-being, of course. Community relations, but all the technical side of mining as well. And how do we know whether a mine is actually doing that? And this is an important topic, but it's a difficult one, because how do you know when you're buying something, especially an end product, what the supply chain has been and what the miner was up to at the beginning? And I've put on this slide some examples of responsible sourcing marks. So here's two that perhaps you would recognize. We buy fair trade coffee all the time without thinking about it. We like to buy fair trade bananas, maybe. I don't know if you know this, in France, the Forestry Stewardship Council, a very famous mark for wood produced from responsible sources that are reforested and looked after. And some of these marks are now well established in everyday use. But there aren't really marks or single easy-to-use schemes for responsible mining. There is a fair mind symbol that goes along similar to fair trade, and that it's very much applies to the small-scale miners. You may have come across the Responsible Jewellery Council that's gaining quite a lot of traction. And if you're in the mining or resources business, you will have come across the International Council on Mining and Metals. That's 10 years old now and was set up by the leading mining companies. So that's 21 big mining companies who got together to really improve the image of mining and act as the leaders in best practice across the mining performance. And there are many other societies and things joined to that. But that's very much that's all industry-led. There's no NGOs or anybody checking what's going on there. That's the industry flagship. And then the thing that's really, I would say, the most important control on new projects are the Equator Principles that go alongside the international finance organisations lending money to people. Before you can get money for big projects, most banks now will insist that you've done the basic environmental and social impact assessments and things that need to be done. So there are some marks and schemes, and you can think about and see where you come across and see them, but there's no single one mark that says this is a responsible mine. And another thing to think about is who cares then about responsible sourcing of mined materials? From different sorts of miners, and the manufacturers of critical metals, they're very much interested. That's their business, working with that particular material. They should care about the source particularly. A manufacturer using those components, well, they might be able to buy other components, so they're more free agents. And often I do this exercise with students. And if you put these groups together, you make a group of each of these topics, you ask them to discuss responsible sourcing of rare earth metals or niobium or tantalum or whatever, and think, who's it really important to? Who would actually pay extra and really work on this topic? The first people to say, we would not pay a penny extra for our goods if they were responsibly sourced, are the student group who are being these people here. So us as consumers, would you pay extra? And of course, that's exactly it. Two things there. First of all, would you pay extra? And just as important, if you're buying a computer or a car, are you going to quiz the car salesman about where the rare earths in the door magnets and the components in the car and the catalytic converter came from? Or are you interested in, you know, fuel efficiency and all the things that normally go with buying cars? There isn't time to go through the thousands of components on the car and sort out if it was responsibly sourced. So until that comes through the supply chain with a mark, it's actually difficult as consumers. And that's something hopefully I'm going to illustrate, is where consumers have had some power. And that's really in this topic here then, is going to the tantalum, the rare metal tantalum. I think I've lost a couple of slides out here somewhere. Oh, okay. Oh, never mind. Okay. So tantalum then comes from this mineral practically exclusively, Colombo tantalite. There's a picture of it here. It's used in a variety of components, but the famous one is capacitors. It makes very small, nice capacitors for electronic goods and particularly for mobile phones. It's one of the things that allows your mobile phone to be as small as it is. And there are a variety of sources. It's practically critical. And the main source is 600, 800 tons per year comes out of the Great Lakes region in Africa, from Rwanda and Burundi, and from DRC. And it's the source out of DRC. It comes in bags. It's very easy to transport around. And that's been fueling the war in the eastern DRC. So along the lines of blood diamonds, there's been blood coltan coming out of this area and smuggled out through Rwanda and Burundi. And that's reached a level where people have cared about it enough that there's now legislation in the States, and there's legislation being talked about in the European Union actively now, where companies who are supplying from these areas now need to show that they have not got conflict minerals in their shipments. And I guess the easy thing then for anyone to do to not have the danger of selling people and using through the supply chain minerals that are financing wars and tremendous problems for the local people would be not to go there at all, not to buy from that region. But that isn't the answer to responsible sourcing in this region. And at risk of maybe making the time a little bit too long, I'm just going to try the experiment here to show in responsible sourcing, if you talk to people about environmental damage and things, they say, yes, yes, okay. But the one thing that always will reach people's passion, if you like, is this conflict minerals agenda when you start to talk about that. And if you ask people to choose a project, if it's between, say, the environmental aspects of a mining project or something on conflict minerals, stopping wars, stopping really human suffering, they will go for that one. And that's why this is leading the responsible mining agenda. And if I can click on this link here to a campaigner called Bandy and Booby. This is a very short TED talk, and we'll just listen to the first minute of it and see why people like students in the University of Exeter are so inspired by this kind of topic. Here it comes.
I want to talk to you today about a difficult topic that is close to me and closer than you might realize to you. I came to the UK 21 years ago as an asylum seeker. I was 21. I was forced to leave the Democratic Republic of the Congo, my home, where I was a student activist. I would love my children to be able to meet my family in the Congo. But I want to tell you what the Congo has got to do with you. But first of all, I want you to do me a favor. Can you all please reach into your pocket and take out your mobile phone? Feel that familiar weight. How naturally your fingers slide towards the buttons. Can you imagine your world without it? It connects us to our loved ones, our family, friends, and colleagues, at home and overseas. It is a symbol of an interconnected world. But what you hold in your hand leaves a bloody trail. And it all boils down to a mineral. Tantalum, mined in the Congo as coltan. It is an anti-corrosive heat conductor. It stores energy in our mobile phones, PlayStations, and laptops. It is used in aerospace and medical equipment as alloys. It is so powerful that we only need tiny amounts. It would be great if the story ended there. Unfortunately, what you hold in your hand has not only enabled incredible technological development and industrial expansion, but it has also contributed to unimaginable human suffering. Since 1996, over 5 million people have died in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Countless women, men, and children have been raped, tortured, or enslaved. Rape is used as a weapon of war, instilling fear and depopulating whole areas. The quest for extracting this mineral has not only aided, but it has fueled the ongoing war in the Congo. But don't throw away your phones yet. 30,000 children are enlisted and are made to fight in armed groups. The Congo consistently scores dreadfully in global health and poverty rankings. But remarkably.
Okay, I think we better leave it there. So Bandy said, don't throw away your phones yet. And you can go and listen to the rest of that. But what he then went on to say was that you need to keep your mobile phones with the tantalum in them, but make sure that the way that the tantalum is getting to those phones is from a responsible source. So he's saying you need still to buy, even from the DRC, but make sure that where it's coming from is not from the mines controlled by the warlords, it's from responsibly run mines. So you need to help these people by setting up responsible mining practices and schemes. And if you want to, as a result of those kind of impassioned campaigns, that you can go and buy a Fairphone, www.fairphone.com, a seriously cool phone that puts social values first. And all of the design and everything for this phone is because of that, because of coltan. And maybe eventually, they're starting off with coltan, but of course then you start to think about the other two-thirds of the periodic table in that mobile phone. How are you going to deal with that? And so that's one of the schemes that's actually now looking directly into mines in the DRC at where that material comes from and how they can help those people. And it isn't just specific schemes like Fairphone. Apple are one of the leaders in this area, and that's because people like students who hear Bandi and Booby, they're not ordinary members of the public, they become campaigners, and they don't know mines in the DRC, they don't know mining companies producing coltan, they don't know people in Burundi, they can't reach to the mines, to the beginning of the supply chain, but they all know Apple. And so that's the people they go after, is the people you wouldn't actually expect to be at the front of responsible sourcing. It's the high-profile manufacturers that actually get targeted by the public. And so Apple now takes this very seriously and has a lot of work going on supplier responsibility, and it's targeted at the conflict minerals, which is tantalum plus tungsten plus tin plus gold, actually, because they're all coming out of that region. But they're also now, I hear, beginning to think about things like rare earths, and so the wider critical metals and generally responsible sourcing agenda, of course. So these are the leaders in doing that. And the scheme now that you may have heard about is that there is a responsible supply chain initiative in the Great Lakes region in Rwanda and Burundi and Eastern DRC, if it can work there. And here's the coltan in the bag, and whenever the bags are shipped now, it goes along with a paper chain. So this is a supply chain initiative. It's a chain of custody, it's called, where everything has to be marked and locked into bins. Here's an example in a mine in Rwanda. When it starts off, they have to know exactly where it came from. Even if it's small-scale miners panning, they need to know where it's come from, get the certificates, and go along the supply chain at every stage to the smelter and know where it's come from. And that's the way that this has been tackled. So there is science that one can do as well, and that is being done alongside, but basically it's a paper chain. And so if you have material now and it's come out of Rwanda, it's highly likely, almost certain, it's been through this system, which allows Rwanda, Burundi, and even Eastern DRC out of the right areas to start to sell and say it's a responsible source. Or does it? Because all of this is about conflict. It's about preventing those warlords running the mines. But it's not about anything else. It doesn't say whether that's an environmentally responsible mine. It doesn't talk about the contamination. It doesn't talk about how geotechnically safe the mine is. It doesn't talk about how the miners are working. And this is the top mine in Rwanda, this picture here. And if you look at that miner, maybe, I don't know what you see, he's wearing a hat, he's wearing a safety boots, he's wearing gloves, that's good. But if any mining professionals here will see the things he isn't wearing, you wouldn't do that in the UK without ear defenders, a mask, and eye protection. And so they're still behind and they're trying to catch up, but mines in Rwanda are between 200 and I would say 20 years behind the state of the art in health and safety. And they're working hard on that, of course, so let me compliment Rwanda rather than criticise them. But this conflict mineral legislation does not take account of the whole remit of responsible mining. Along with the tantalum, I said there are other minerals included, so sources of tungsten and tin are also included in that conflict mineral legislation. So let's hop from the Great Lakes region to a European mine, a brand new world-class mine, which is just being built exactly now and will have its grand opening ceremony in September this year, being developed by an Australian company called Wolf Minerals, mining wolframite here. And so do they make a big thing that this is a responsibly sourced mine and is not from a conflict source and is environmentally friendly and so on? Well, if you go to their website, you'll see actually that they're proud of the fact they've got their ISO 14001 environmental management system in place already, ready to go before the mine opens. And you have to look quite hard to find that. But they don't make any explicit mention of responsible sourcing anywhere. But they do take advantage of the critical metals agenda. And every meeting we have in the UK, if it's about critical metals, there'll be a representative of Wolf Minerals there. So that's actually been a very useful agenda to them. And you'll find all about China actually dominating tungsten supply on their website. But for responsible sourcing, they know they need to be seen as a good supplier, but they're not really putting that anywhere high up their agenda yet. So let me swap then from the conflict minerals and take a diversion to another critical metal, niobium, which is used as mainly as ferroniobium in the steel industry. It's another really small niche metal with 59,000 tons produced in 2014. And here the main supplier isn't China, for a change, not coming from Great Lakes region, it's Brazil. That's the main supplier. And out of that 59,000 tons, 53,000 tons is coming from Brazil, and almost all of that comes from the Araxá mine run by a company called CBMM. So just one company is absolutely dominating the supply of niobium, and that's why it always gets fair and square in the critical metals rectangle. And so we talk about, if you like, in critical metals, we might have heroes and villains, and the villains are the people who are kind of dominating the supply, if you like, and that's quite often China, who are the clever people who've got themselves to that situation. But in this case, of course, it's CBMM in Brazil, who are, if you like, the villains of our story, because they're dominating supply. But in terms of responsible sourcing, CBMM in Araxá in Brazil and their niobium mine was the first metallurgy and mining company in the world to gain the ISO 14001 environmental management standard in 1997. They've been at the environmental best practice game longer than many mining companies. And I've known this company for a long time, and they've had many initiatives around community and workforce well-being and conservation. They saw the importance of responsible mining agenda a long time ago. So they're environmental heroes. And why are they the critical metals villains? They can't put themselves out of business. What are they going to do about it? And so, of course, for this company, the critical metals agenda is something they really don't like. Why should they? It's making potential purchasers of niobium move away from niobium because it's a dangerous critical metal these days. And so the challenge for CBMM is to bring into their responsible mining agenda an additional aspect. They have to show that not only are they environmentally and socially responsible, but they can also somehow or other overcome this criticality problem for all of their customers. And so they have supplies lodged in all kinds of places around the world and centres in many places, and they make a big thing of that. And so that's an extra challenge for them in responsible sourcing. And now let me come to rare earths. And show how this is really the headline often of the critical metals agenda, with the light rare earths dominated about 90% by China, and the heavy rare earths dominated 99%. All heavy rare earths basically are coming out of China. There are some major uses of rare earths, such as the magnets for wind turbines, and you can see the size of some of the wind turbines. We look at the aeroplane there that Siemens are putting into place now. And here is a link to an article in the UK newspaper, The Daily Mail, from a few years ago. And here are the villagers, it says their names, standing on the edge of a 6-mile-wide toxic lake in Bioto, China, that's devastated their farmland and ruined the health of the people in their community. terrible pollution around the Bayoto and Bayanobo mine. And that's the case. There's environmental damage around, I would say, all of the rare earth mines in China. So why are the Daily Mail in the UK so concerned about Chinese villagers? And of course, what they're doing is not just, let me say, trying to help the Chinese villagers. This is an anti-wind energy article. It's saying, if you put up these wind turbines for your clean energy, look what you're doing to these people in China. And at the moment, we have no choice in rare earths. All of our rare earths, 90% of lights, 100% of heavies, are coming out of China. And so every day, with your phones, your computers, the lights, everything that's your cars, everything that's using rare earths, we are contributing to those environmental problems and the problems for the people in China. And as yet, we heard a very nice talk from Alain this morning. We have little choice about that. But Siemens and their wind turbine have just done a deal with Molycorp, who produce from Mountain Pass in the USA, one of the mines outside of China. And one of the reasons that they did that was so that they could have a responsible as well as a secure supply. So again, some of the manufacturers are beginning to bring responsible sourcing into their agenda. But when we talk to exploration companies now, looking at some of the deposits, and here are the rare earth mines that are working, we've seen that already this morning, and here are the many deposits around the world that people are working on, the BGS map here, they say that there is no premium on responsible sourcing of rare earths. They cannot ask for any extra money for their material off of their mines on the grounds that they're an environmentally and socially responsible mining operation. So they've got to compete with the cheapest that there is in the world. But the kinds of rare earth deposits being looked at range hugely. There are many, many different kinds of rocks now under consideration, and they range from igneous carbonatite rocks, the nepheline syenites, other types of igneous rocks, to things already mined for apatite, to even people looking under the sea for deposits, to weathered, easily friable material, to clays that people can use. And the old source that people used to use was titania and zirconia mineral sands, and then taking the rare earths as a byproduct. And so there's actually a good news story in amongst all of these different sorts of deposits. There's some more pictures of weathered deposits to show the huge range even of weathered rare earth deposits, is that the characteristics of those are really variable. And on this graph, you see carbonatites tend to be quite high grade. If I follow these squares along here, deposits quite large. There are ones called nepheline syenites with more heavy rare earths, but they're low grade deposits. You'd have to make much bigger holes in the ground. You need a lot more energy for mining for these ones. There's the tiny deposits in China that produce the heavy rare earths. Come to those in a minute. They're very easy to leach, very easy to mine. But of course, tremendous environmental problems in China. And then all kinds of placer deposits, very low grade. And so these characteristics here can be converted into the environmental characteristics of the mine. How much energy do you need to mine it? What will be the environmental disturbance and the footprint of the mine? You can get that right from the very first stages of geological exploration as soon as you see those kind of figures. And the other main problem that Alain pointed out this morning is in processing the minerals on rare earth deposits. And there are many different types of minerals being looked at. These ones in red, nobody's ever done this commercially before. Some of them are more efficient sources than others, and all that can be taken into account right at the beginning, and we call that geometallurgy, understanding how these things will perform. And there's some pretty pictures of some rare earth minerals, some quite complicated textures for applied mineralogists and mineral processors to get to grips with. But all of these need different amounts of acid and different processing techniques. And here's one of the key problems with rare earth deposits is the amount of radioactivity. So we've taken the minerals that people have been looking at and calculated their radioactivity. You can see a range here, but you can generally see as soon as you know the mineral, basically the more rare earths, monazite and xenotene, will be more radioactive. If you have a eudialyte or an apatite deposit, you have much less problems with radioactivity. So again, there's a wide population and wide variation. And you can put these together into a diagram of environmental characteristics. So you can list all the deposit types, and you're using a geometallurgy, geology approach to this, going through into the processing and thinking about the environmental disturbance and so on. And so let me highlight a couple on here. Here's a carbonatite, that's not bad, reasonably easy to work. Minerals in there have lower radioactivity than many others, although they are slightly radioactive. Reasonable resource efficiency, so not bad. Mineral sands would be brilliant deposits if it wasn't for the radioactivity. So if somebody could solve this one problem, this would immediately become a really favourite source of rare earths from the environmental point, and certainly from the economic point of view, and would solve our problems of criticality. And here's these funny ones in South China that form all the heavy rare earths, cause tremendous environmental degradation in China. But if you look across here, if we were clever and could produce these nice and carefully, then actually, apart from the fact that they don't produce byproducts, they should be very good, environmentally friendly sources. So some of the worst things at the moment should actually be the best, we think. And that's why we have now a big project in the UK, where these are some pictures of what it looks like in China. But we think with some clever science, we could, these should be possible to mine in a very environmentally efficient way. And in fact, there are probably quite a lot of deposits around the world that are very easily leachable deposits and can skip all of the processing stages that use so much energy. And if we could get that working, we could have a really low energy, environmentally friendly source of rare earths for the future. And we can take that further and start to put some numbers on the energy that can be used. And you can do this even before the mine is working. If you know what processes are likely to be used, you just go to the mining textbooks and look up the energy needed. It's standard stuff in mining engineering. And so you can start to compare, even quantitatively from the first stages, different kinds of ore deposits. And that's something really promising, I think, for rare earth deposits. And so then to wrap up, who cares about responsible sourcing? Well, I think we've seen that it's activists like Bandi and Booby and the people that he inspires that have really got to this stage number three, which might be not what you'd think to begin with. And they are the people that are leading the raw materials responsible sourcing agenda. But it's not yet a main issue in mining, except insofar as it applies and the parts that apply to conflict minerals. And so that's why they've been leading the assurance schemes, but they're not comprehensive schemes. Some people have problems and they're now needing to bring in criticality to their responsibility agenda, such as the CBMM example. And when we look carefully, where there are new deposits having to be explored to overcome problems of criticality, there are opportunities for really choosing the very best and most responsible mining practices and sources. Thank you very much.